Hello and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum, the State versus Patricia Rohr. This is Colin Miller. As always, I am joined by my co-host, Rabia Chaudhry. Rabia, how are you doing?
Good. Hi, Colin. How are you doing?
Doing great. And we're joined again by Jennifer Leahy, Research and Investigative Assistant. She has been working with Rabia first in the Jason Carroll case and now in the Patricia Rohr case. And so hello again, Jennifer.
Hi, Colin. Hi, Rabia.
Hey, Jen. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Yeah, and so we are going to discuss all things episode 2 phone tag in the Patricia Rohr series. But before we go there, I wanted to ask the two of you about this case that I've just started following recently that I'm really interested in to see what's going to happen after this. This is the conviction of a man named Todd Mullis. And so Todd and his wife are farmers in Iowa. His wife is found with six puncture wounds in her chest, and they are determined to be caused by a corn rake that the couple uses in the farming.
Oh, I have a vague recollection of this case. Okay.
Yeah. She was having an affair, and that was the alleged motive for the killing. The theory of the prosecution at trial was that he had found out about the cheating and had attacked her with this corn rake, causing these 6 puncture wounds. At trial, defense counsel proffered the theory that someone else murdered the wife. And so last year they had PCR hearings at which an expert testified, "It is my theory that the puncture wounds came not from an attack, but from her tripping, falling on this 4-pronged rake. She then tried to get up and fell back down, causing the 2 additional puncture wounds." And just, I think, 2 days ago, the court denied relief and found there was not evidence of ineffective assistance of counsel because Todd Mullis had claimed, "I wanted to go with the theory of her falling on the rake at trial. My attorney went with the theory that someone else murdered her," and so the court just denied relief. And so I'll start with you, Rabia. What are your initial impressions about kind of hearing the facts on this case?
I mean, I don't know enough, but I mean, and I don't know like how severe her injuries were, right? I mean, are we talking about like little, I mean, it had to be like quite deep for it to actually have killed her. And I don't think, I have rakes all around the house. I do a lot of work out in the yard and garden and stuff. And I know they're farmers and stuff, but I cannot imagine falling that hard that it would injure somebody to that extent that they wouldn't survive it. I guess he was convicted. Clearly he was convicted. Was he sentenced to life? Is that what happened?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, on the surface, just, you know, and not knowing a lot, I feel like the jury probably got this right.
What are your thoughts on hearing these facts, Jennifer?
Well, I just looked up some images of corn rake because I didn't know what it was.
Mm-hmm. That's a good idea. Let me do that.
I don't know anything about this case, so this is the first I'm hearing of it, but I'm taking notes so I can go down, you know, maybe a rabbit hole as a little treat later.
That's a scary looking rake. I got to say, I just looked that up.
Yeah,
that's
not to make light of the case. Sorry, I wasn't saying that flippantly. Yeah, that rake is intense. That rake is not like your average spring rake you use around the yard. This is like, those prongs look sharp and long and yeah, so I don't know. I don't know anything about it, but I'm very, very curious.
Yeah. And I posted on social media and I've gotten a split opinion so far with some listeners saying he was wrongfully convicted and others saying he's guilty as sin. So if you're listening to this and have any opinions, let us know, because if enough of you think this might be an innocence case, we can at least, you know, reach out to the attorneys, maybe do an episode down the road covering it and seeing.
Wait, Colin, the injuries were in the front, right? Not
the front.
Back.
Yes.
Now, if they were in the back, I might be more prone to thinking I can see somebody falling back. Because when you fall backwards, usually it's like with kind of your full weight.
Yeah.
When you fall frontwards, right? Like people,
you brace yourself
and you're able to kind of like avoid, you know what I mean? I just, again, depending on how deep it was, I find it really hard to believe. On top of which, you know, the added, you know, look, we all know that half of married people would go to prison just based on things like somebody's having an affair or you know, something happened. There's always like, right. you always got to be careful, like what kind of messages you're sending to your partner and stuff, because you never know where, how they're going to end up. And something might point back at you. So I'm not saying that there is motive, but I just feel like, I don't know. It's a hard sell for me, I got to say. What did you think about the ineffective assistance claim though?
I mean, I haven't listened to Todd Mullis's testimony, presumably at the PCR, and it's all on Court TV to watch. Presumably he took the stand and said, I told my attorney to go with this theory of her falling on the rake, and they went with the option of claiming alternate suspect, but I'm guessing the judge didn't find him credible.
I mean, look, if I was defense counsel, I think it's a stronger theory to say somebody else killed her versus she fell, for the same reasons that I don't feel like it's credible that she could have been, that she could have died that way. But anyhow, interesting case.
Yeah.
All right.
And so pivoting from that to episode 2 of the Patricia Rohr series, this is our episode Phone Tag. And as you heard, this covered everything that was seen and not seen on the day that Joe and her son disappeared, as well as at the end of the episode, the phone tag, where we have the husband of Joe, Andy, calling, making contact with Patricia Rohr's mother and being told that I called her, she was asleep in her bed down in North Carolina, this murder having been committed in Pennsylvania on that day. And so my first point I wanted to address with both of you is this witness, Stacy Fulper, right? She is the neighbor who is doing the laundry. And the question is, did she in fact see Joe and her son on the day they disappeared? Is she making things up to insert herself in the situation? Is she confabulating? And so Robbie and Jennifer, we have the timestamp of Andy's mother, who says around 1:15 p.m., I called Joe and we made plans to meet, and she was about to head out the door. Stacy Fulper says around 12:30, I'm putting the laundry down and I see Joe putting her son in the car seat in the car. Around 1:15 p.m., I come back down to put the clothes in the dryer. The car is gone. I come down again at 3 p.m. and the car is gone again. And the question is, can we synchronize these two? And so here's my thought upon initially seeing this, and I wonder if you two agree or disagree. Is it possible that Stacy is just misremembering, and in fact, she saw Joe putting her son in the car seat at 1:15, which would sync pretty well with Andy's mother saying, around 1:15 I called and she was just about to head out the door. Does that make any sense, or am I reaching?
Here's the thing. I mean, yes, I think there's a number of possibilities here. I think number one, maybe she got the time wrong, although she did seem, she said that she put the baby down and she looked at the clock sitting right there where the baby is, like she had a specific, you know, memory of that. The second thing could be that, you know, a couple of days before Joe disappeared, she went to visit some friends. And I'm wondering if she's remembering that day, because around three, you know, Joe's car would not have been back around 3 o'clock. I don't know what time, but I think Joe would have left by 12. I think Joe was already in New Jersey meeting her friends by 1 o'clock. Mm-hmm. So that also doesn't sync up. And the third possibility is she's just misremembering another day, or she's making up something on purpose, because as I think we talked about in the episode, Fulper didn't report this initially at all.
Right. It's her friend who first says.
Right. She mentioned it to another neighbor, and that neighbor mentioned it to the FBI when they talked to her, and the FBI went back to Fulper and they're like, did you tell this to the neighbor? And she's like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And I feel like it's hard for me to find it credible, number one, because of that. Number two, because of the description that Fulper gives, and we're going to get into that, because the description is not going to match the description of Joe when she's eventually found.
The clothes that she says.
The clothing, yeah.
Right.
It is summer. Finally, it's here. And summer always changes how I get dressed, and I'm sure that's true for you too. I want pieces that feel lighter, that are more breathable, things that are easy but still put together. That is why I keep coming back to Quince. They've got high-quality essentials that feel and look amazing, like breathable linens and soft organic cottons, well-made basics but without the luxury markup. It is that rare balance where everything feels elevated but still effortless. And if you are a woman over 30, I know you have noticed that so much stuff in the stores, it just doesn't speak to us anymore. I want to feel like a grown-up when I get dressed up. That is why I love the elegant, classy, classic pieces that Quince has. Not just for women, but for men too. Quince European linen pants and shirts are the perfect warm weather upgrade to add to your rotation, starting at just $34. They've got tees that are soft and easy to wear, lightweight cotton sweaters that are perfect for cooler summer nights, and everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen, so you are paying for quality, not brand markup. And by the way, Quince also goes way beyond clothing. They've got custom upholstered sofas, ceramic cookware, premium bedding. It is the kind of brand you end up recommending to everyone for everything. I have stocked up on my summer linen from Quince. I just grabbed myself their 100% European linen maxi skirt in 3 different colors, $50, and a couple of their linen shirt dresses. Listen, I plan on spending the entire summer in these pieces. Elevated looks without elevated prices. So elevate your summer wardrobe too. Go to quince.com/towardjustice for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/towardjustice for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/towardjustice.
Yeah, Jen, what are your thoughts on this idea of maybe it was the 1:15 p.m. sighting where she saw her putting the sun in the car seat?
Yeah, it's reflecting like me. Perhaps she got the time wrong, but the initial statement saying I didn't see anything, that was like her first thought, right? So I also think she's got a young baby, just the same as Joanne had, and so I can see, with routines and being home and doing maybe similar things every day, I can see how it might be quite easy to remember, like totally unintentionally, a different day.
Yeah.
But is it possible that the time is wrong? Yeah, that's true too. But there are some other factors to consider.
I mean, I think if I remember correctly, Stacey Flipper was interviewed like the very next day after the disappearance. So
yeah, it was very soon after.
For her not to mention it.
Right, for her not to mention the first interview would have been really weird.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Robbie, you mentioned the timestamp, right? That Stacey Fulper tethers her memory to looking at the clock and seeing 1:30. If we turn to Andy's mother, when she says, I called Joe around 1:15, we made these plans to go shopping. Is there anything about her memory that's tied to 1:15? Or is this just early afternoon?
No. She was watching either a TV show or listening to a radio show. I can't remember. She specifically...
I think she said she watched Mass on TV and then had lunch or something like that. Yeah.
She gave a pretty specific details of kind of her daily routine. Mm-hmm. But also the fact that she's like, then I put on my shoes and my coat and I'm just waiting. That also, if she's thinking my daughter-in-law is going to be here in 15 or 20 minutes... And then she's standing and waiting from that. I mean, like, I feel like that gives us a little bit of an idea of when she should have talked to Joe, if she's being accurate.
Yeah. And then from that, if we feel pretty good, and we have questions, obviously, but if you feel good generally about Andy's mother calling around 1:15 p.m. and that Joe would be leaving the house shortly thereafter, we went through the laundry list of witnesses in the area who didn't see anything that afternoon. We mentioned Jamie Smith.
Yeah, not even all of them. We went through some, like, a very partial list, by the way.
Ones I wanted to focus on is sort of that 1:30 to 2 p.m. period, because Jamie Smith, the neighbor, says, between 1:30 and 2, I'm walking in the neighborhood. Daryl Paul, I left McCarty's at 1:30 to go back to work. Michael Check, I'm outside around 1:30 working with heavy equipment. I know the whole gist of the episode was it's tough to make sense of this timeline, but... what do you think when you hear about this timeline of 1:15 p.m. for the call, she's just about to leave, and then all these witnesses right around 1:30 who are right there who see nothing? What does that tell us?
What that tells me is that nothing happened. What I think is that nothing happened right outside that house at 1:30. I think Joe either got in her car and drove away, and whatever happened to her happened somewhere else. Or the only reason we even know that Joe might be have been alive on that day was because the mother-in-law is saying I had a phone call with her. If you remove that phone call, we have no other way of corroborating that Joe was even alive. What we can say is Peggy, her sister, spoke to her the evening before. I think it was around 4 or 5 o'clock. That I think we can put a pin in for sure, that Joe was definitely alive on the evening of December 14th. Was Joe alive on December 15th? Was she, I mean, like, has she disappeared before? Like, we don't know, you know? And we raised this question about the parents before because so much of what they've said, nobody else can corroborate. So if that's, and you know, many listeners have brought this up, that is that his only alibi is his parents? Well, yeah.
And Jennifer, what are your thoughts about this timeline of the 1:30 to 2 o'clock hour, which I kind of see as critical here?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I have the same questions and thoughts as Rabia on this.
And if we're sticking with what Robbie just mentioned about, Andy being the initial suspect, we mentioned Karen, the friend of Joe in the episode, who said, A, Joe is planning to leave Andy after the holidays. And again, this disappearance occurs in December. And then B, she says she was secretly saving up money to be able to effectuate this departure from the marriage and from Andy. And so, as we said in the episode again, as Robbie just noted earlier, we don't have an initial accounting of this. It comes later during a TV interview. But I wonder, in terms of this having legs, Jen, is there any corroboration of Karen whatsoever in terms of other witnesses saying this, or money that in fact Joe is sequestering, or is this just on an island by itself?
I have not seen anything like anybody else saying something along the lines of what Karen says about actively planning to leave him or saving money. I have not seen that anywhere else. And then, and even in her earlier statements, she doesn't mention that. You know, I have seen people saying that, you know, Joanne was very independent and, you know, like to do her own thing. Like, yeah, like these general character traits, but I haven't seen, or, you know, like the thing about working at the bank and sort of like getting into it with, you know, with management, like being a very good teller, but maybe not a great employee in terms of relationships with management. But I, no, I haven't seen anybody else say this. And Karen says it years and years later, right? So I don't know what to make of that.
We discussed this on the episode. What's your ultimate takeaway? Is this just she never liked Andy and she's kind of saying this after the fact, or you think there are any legs to this story she tells on TV?
I mean, the problem again is that this comes years and years after all this happens. This is not, I mean, like when she was interviewed after the disappearance, like why didn't this come? Why didn't she bring this up before? I just don't trust it when it's not part of initial reporting, because that would have given the police like a reason to really drill down harder on Andy, which I think they tried to anyways, but it just didn't go anywhere. But I just don't like, you know, as Jen said, nobody else has reported that necessarily. Yeah, we just don't have any other evidence to show that Joe had any intention of going anywhere. In fact, she had just met friends a couple of days earlier. She again talked to them about like their plans moving in Colorado. She seemed excited about that. Yeah.
And in terms of meeting with friends, we also discussed in the episode how Joe had recently gone back to her old job at Six Flags to see this male friend as well as other friends. And we had a question from a listener, Quiana Cantu. Does anyone know if Annie was upset about Joe visiting her old coworker? Again, this male coworker who later became law enforcement. Anything there, Jen, in terms of Annie being upset about this?
Haven't seen anybody voicing anything along those lines in official statements anyways or elsewhere.
Yeah. And that makes me wonder in terms of when we flip it, and that is, we know that Joe is quite upset when Patricia calls. And in fact, that's what leads Andy to think this reaction by Joe might have instigated something in Patricia Rohr. And so, Rabia, do we know why Joe was so confrontational when Patricia called? Is there anything beyond what we presented in the episode?
Yeah, there is. You know, and this is something I'm planning on talking about later as we get into how Patricia becomes a prime suspect, but it certainly doesn't hurt to mention now that apparently, you know, Joe was fiery, man. She was a feisty woman, and you know, she, you know, Andy says in one interview, well, you know, she's Italian, and you know, she says what she's going to say. But she was not having it when it came to Patty. First of all, she knew that Patty and Andy had a long time relationship. But she also had found pictures of Patty at some point somewhere in the house, not necessarily because Andy was holding on to them, you know, who knows, but, and she had a big fight about that with him. She got angry about that. She had mentioned to other friends that, you know, she refers to Patty as, I think she referred to Patty as that bitch. And I think she just didn't like the fact that Patty and him kept in touch. And a lot of this keeping in touch, by the way, was not one, it wasn't one-sided. Andy himself also would once in a while send, like, you know, a Christmas card or just, you know, like communicate as well. And they both kept in touch. What's important to note, and we, again, we'll get into this is that later, is that this was Patty's pattern. She kind of kept in touch with everybody. She, you know, she and other exes that, you know, she had to date as well, except for one particular one that, you know, had right. a really
Which
bad.
We'll get to
yeah. But yeah, it wasn't unusual. But I think Joe also kept in touch with all of her, you know, ex-colleagues and male friends. And Andy, I don't think Andy had an issue with it. I never heard Andy say anything about it. In fact, one of the first people he contacts is that guy to find out. Like, so he has his contact information. I don't think he's bothered by it at all.
Yeah, and to that point you just mentioned, Robbie, this one ex who was known to drive a black truck and was known to be abusive. And in episode one, we discussed how Andy told the authorities there were multiple people who saw this black truck in the area. And I know in the notes here, you wanted to follow up on that because as we go through the file, even though Andy says other people saw this truck, the file tends to show what?
Yeah, the police reports show that as they're speaking to folks, as they're interviewing folks and asking them, you know, did you met? Because Andy never tells the police who told me about the black truck. He just says that people have told me. So now the police are trying to figure out who it was. So they're asking people, did you tell Andy? And I think at least two, if not three different witnesses said, oh, no, Andy told us. Andy said that he had seen a black truck or that he had heard there was a black truck. Like, it didn't come from us. So I think that's kind of really important to note is that it seems like Andy is giving the police information that's coming from him, but he's attributing it to somebody else. And I think that's highly suspicious.
Mm-hmm. Jen, what are your thoughts when you see first that Andy says all these people saw this black truck and then it turns out that he's the source for all of this?
Yeah, that gave me pause. Like, I think that some of the folks were like, no, he asked me if I had seen a black truck or something. So it's more him posing this idea or suggesting this idea, something along those lines. Yeah, it's a different way to frame it, right?
It reminds me a lot of, by the way, it reminds me a lot of, if folks remember, I know people don't remember like all the minute details of the Heyman Lee case. But when Heyman Lee disappeared and they were looking for her, the police were told by Hayes' boyfriend at the time, Donald Kleindienst, he told the police that there was a rumor that she was going to leave for California. And when we traced the rumor, it actually came from Don himself. And nobody else ever mentioned that Hay might be leaving for California. And you always have to wonder about that.
And I wonder, and this is a really interesting question from Rothwell ZE, and we touched upon this a bit last episode where Andy uses we, his demeanor is kind of odd, and we just discussed this attribution issue. Rothwell ZE says, I wonder whether Andy has ever been assessed for autism. A lot of the patterns of communication the team are questioning that make him look guilty are common with autism. For example, over-explaining why he found the phone line cut. A lot of people with autism have what people call autistic intuition. It isn't intuition at all. It is merely good pattern recognition. But they're used to seeing this as others don't and having to explain themselves as to how they found the thing they found. Otherwise, often people don't believe them. So this is kind of a hot button issue now in the wrongful conviction space about people on the autism spectrum being accused and wrongfully convicted. And so I wonder, you know, Robbie or Jen, is there anything in the file? And there's a lot of undiagnosed autism, but anything in the file about Andy being on the spectrum or...
I mean, this is 1994. Right. You know, they were not considering anything like this for sure. You know, that's an interesting possibility in terms of explaining how he communicated. I don't know if it explains some of the things he did necessarily. I don't think it explains, for example, why 19 screws would be unscrewed and the 20th is left in. I mean, there's things that can, might be explained by that, but there's things that absolutely cannot.
Right. And Jen, what are your thoughts on this? Is this something that, having gone through the files, this is a possibility in your mind, or red herring?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an excellent thing to always keep in mind, right? And I am not, when I'm looking through this, you know, I mean, I don't want to judge his affect, the way he, his tone, the way he presents, like, I'm trying to more look at, like, the facts, like Robbie was saying, like, what actually happened than the actions. And yeah, the screws, the way the phone line was spliced together, even though he'd been really concerned about not moving the car because he didn't want to tamper with things, but then the phone line is spliced together. Like, there's just some things that strike me as odd, like independent of his tone or you know, the words that he said.
Yeah. I'm going to do a 1-2 punch, which is first parallels the Todd Mullis case a bit, and then two, what I see is maybe some of the strongest evidence of innocence. And so we have a question from Danielle Marie. I saw a Dateline episode a few years ago, and it would take some convincing new details for me to believe it was not her, Patricia. We'll discuss that later in terms of where the bodies were found. But in terms of the coverage on Dateline and other media, looking online, there's a lot of people completely convinced that Patricia is guilty, others who strongly believe in her innocence. Jen, I'll start with you. In terms of how this case has been covered in the media previously, have you found that that coverage is more salacious and one-sided as opposed to reporting the facts? Or what have you seen in this coverage of Patricia's case to this point?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen at least two styles of coverage. There's some that definitely it seems a little bit more flashy and maybe salacious. That's not the date. I wouldn't say. I think if she's talking about Dateline, she's maybe talking about the Keith Morrison special. I'm not sure if it was actually Dateline, but I've seen some other coverage that definitely skews towards, you know, like the scorned woman or the, you know, the ex mad ex girlfriend that seems skewed in that direction. But then I've seen a couple other specials that were produced within the past 10 years that that seem to take that are maybe a little bit more thoughtful and are trying to re-examine things and re-interview folks. And I don't know, they seem a little bit more balanced to me, that make me question things and maybe think that maybe, you know, that maybe they didn't get it right.
And Robbie, in watching some of that coverage, did you ever have any doubts when you saw that coverage about Patricia's innocence?
No. No, here's the thing. There's not a single case that Undisclosed is going to cover in which there's not going to be media coverage that makes the defendant come out as guilty. I mean, like, that's just, we are always fighting back against the narrative that exists. So, you know, there's that Starz show that was done. What's it called? The Wrong Man? Or I can't remember the name of
the
Wrong Man. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Wrong Man, two episodes on the Roar case. Yep.
On Starz, right. And so, you know, they raise a lot of questions. Even the Keith Morrison special about it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like, oh, look at what happened in this case. It wasn't just reporting that this terrible thing happened. And this was like an examination of, did they get it right or did it get wrong? They did raise questions. And the reason the media keeps returning to this, at least I think in the last 10, 15 years, is because there are questions about whether or not this was a wrongful conviction. Obviously, if you look at media from 94, 95, 96, 97, whatever, that era is a different. It's just like, it's, you know, Patricia Rohrer is painted as guilty even before she's tried. Having said that, you know, people need to understand that, like, every time a case like this comes to us and then people say, well, you know, I saw so-and-so reporting, what you are seeing in the coverage that makes you think she's guilty are the same things the jury bought, mm-hmm. right? It's the same. When people say, what about the other side? The other side already happened. The other side was a trial where they got it wrong and the jury didn't get the whole picture. Evidence was kept out. Evidence was never discovered. Evidence was obscured by the state. I mean, all kinds of reasons the jury doesn't get the full picture. And so that's why I'm like, you know, just because, you know, like a 1-hour special didn't spend 8 years investigating. Oh, well, I mean, like, I'm sorry, I'm not swayed by that. We've had too many innocence experts touch this case before it even came to us that we know that there's serious issues with this conviction.
And then turning to that innocence issue. So let me set this up, first of all, by saying, a huge part of our episode was about this sort of Rashomon effect of various witnesses saying the Corolla, Joe's car, was or was not in McCarty's at various points during the day. And Rabia, as you added in the notes for me to address, there's this other witness we didn't mention, Brian Paul, right? And he leaves work at 4 p.m. and he says what to the police?
He says it wasn't there. He says it wasn't there. And so I think the evidence tends to show that the car was not there until, I don't know, maybe late that evening, maybe after the dinner rush at McCarty's. People who were parked in that lot were like, it wasn't there. You know, we know it was there. We're pretty sure it was there by like
11:20.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But before that, I mean, any time I would say between, like, I don't know, 8, 9, 10, 11, like, is I think when that car was put there. So the question is, and again, this actually goes back to like the time stamp issue we were talking about earlier, is when Andy came home, if the car wasn't back there and it wasn't at McCarty's lot, where was it? That means Joe got in the car and drove off alone or with somebody. She's not. So like she's not there is what I'm trying to say. Or the car was at the house the whole time. And Andy or somebody moved it to the lot to make it look like she had been abducted, because he was very invested in making sure that everybody thought Joe was abducted.
Following up on this issue of the call to Patricia's mother, that call is at 3:14 a.m. It's not until 5 a.m. that Andy calls the police to tell them the phone line has been cut. Rabia, what do you make about this timing of calling Patricia's mother before reporting the cut phone line?
Well, the thing is, okay, and Jen and I discussed this, because what happens is when Patricia's mom is spoken to, I think it's like 2 days, maybe 2 days or 3 days after this happens. I can't remember exactly, but it's her first conversation with the police about this. And she says, yep, Andy called me, said he wants to know where Patty is, says his wife and son are missing, and told me the phone lines has been, like, the back door was jimmied up and the phone lines were cut. If that's what he told her in the first conversation, that conversation happened 2 hours before he reported the phone lines being cut. And so, you know, Jen brought up the possibility that, well, man, you know, she did speak to Andy like a couple days later too, maybe, or it was maybe the next day. Maybe like she's conflating the conversations. Again, unless he told her the next day and she's just like confusing this. But, you know, she's specifically, the police are asking her what happened in the conversation the night he called you. And so if she is accurate about that, then something is really off. Because he doesn't report the phone lines being cut until 2 hours after this call with her. And again, it's just more weirdness. I mean, the whole thing about the phone line is weird anyways. And we talked about this, about like why, how the phone line was cut, why it was cut where it was cut. Why would he splice it back together? Why would somebody cut one line and not the main line? Like none of it makes sense. Why would you even break into somebody's house if you're going to abduct her outside anyways?
Yeah, these are all questions that... We're trying to figure it out all these years later. Yeah. Probably the scariest part of the episode for me, and it shows you how easily we can have wrongful convictions, even though it ended up being something they could dispel in this case, was this employee at the local airport who was certain they saw Joe appearing nervous with a man going on this flight. They're even shown a photo of Joe, and they're certain this is Joe, and it turns out they're completely wrong on both
and
the day.
He even gets hypnotized.
As well as the person, right? And so, I mean, is this not just Rabia Exhibit A about, even though they could dispel this, this shows you how easily witnesses can be mistaken in identifications and the day something even occurred.
Oh my gosh. Let me tell you, there are two women who live in my area and part of a large social circle. I get them confused all the time. I have seen them both at least 10 times in the last few years, and I still get them confused. This is how memory works. This is how like people are. And this guy, I mean, it wasn't even a question. The police positively identified the woman and the child that he thought he saw and he thought were Joe and Alex. And that's, look, he wasn't the only one. There was a woman who said that she saw Joe at a convenience store and was positive of it. And this was, and she said that the woman bought like all this, you know, like $100 worth of stuff from the store and like some baby stuff, and there's a baby there, all these things. And I think this was reported weeks later. I mean, I'm not saying it's beyond any possibility, but my strong sense is that by the time Andy called the police that night, Joe was already dead. That's what I'm guessing. So, yeah, this is exactly how it works. I mean, look, I mean, if anybody follows them making a murder case, I know we talked about this, Colin, like on last week's Patreon episode. Stephen Avery, before he was convicted of this particular crime he's serving time for, was convicted of a rape for 18 years by the woman who said that she saw him up close and personal because he sexually assaulted her and she had misidentified him. This happens all the
Right.
time. It is scary.
And on the other hand, we have around 50 people served at lunchtime at Cardi's, around 50 more served at dinner. Not a single one of them, including witnesses who said I would frequently look out of the window into the parking lot to check what was going on there. None of them saw anything, none of them heard anything. Jen, what does that tell you as we're trying to create this narrative of what happened that during both the lunch rush and the dinner rush, nobody saw anything?
Yeah, anything can happen, as y'all said, right, in this episode, like anything can happen, but it seems a little strange. It also, what struck me is like whoever did this, if it went down that way, was bold and confident or not thinking, I mean, it seems like the worst possible time to attempt something. Like, why would you choose to do that at that time in such a busy area? It's kind of hard to wrap my mind around.
Yeah, and by the way, and we'll get to this too, but Patty is not unfamiliar with the area at all. I mean, she lived in the area. She knew the area. So, yeah, for anybody who is familiar with the area and all the businesses and all the foot traffic and other deliveries happening, constant deliveries happening, a lot of the work that was happening in the area were people who were installing things in different like businesses and homes. So they're bringing their work trucks in and out, landscapers, all kinds of things, and it was just constant movement.
And in terms of that, Rabia, following up about Patricia knowing the area, we had another question, I think also from manager Karen, which is, she said, I had a few thoughts in the first two episodes. First, the cordless drill. The whole scenario does not make sense. You have to believe that Patricia had knowledge that the back door was boarded up and it was boarded up with screws and not nails. How tall is the board at the top of the door? Were there screws at the top? How tall is Patricia? Would she have been able to reach the top screws? After that, we are to believe that she had either purchased or had a cordless drill. Next, she would need screw bits for the cordless drill. Does she need a flathead or a Phillips? After she planned that out, she also needed a noisy cordless drill to take out 20 screws in the middle of the day. She drove 9 hours in the night, committed two murders, hid the bodies, etc. A bridge too far for manager Karen. I mean, what are your thoughts, Jen, in hearing this kind of laid out by a listener about the implausibility that Patricia would attempt this murder, as Rabia said, knowing the area?
Yeah, I agree. It seems bizarre.
Here's what I'm going to say. If Patricia or anybody who is an unlikely suspect, let's say it's a stranger in the area and they've been watching Joe because she takes her baby for a walk every day and they want to hurt Joe, all they have to do is break into the house and kill her there and leave. Because who is going to tie them to that scene? It is so much riskier taking a person to a second location, moving them out of wherever they're moving her to, and we'll get to where Joe eventually is found. I mean, there's no reason to do that. Patty could have knocked on the door and killed her and left, or broke into the basement and killed her and left. None of it makes sense. And yes, and thank you so much for bringing up this idea that I mean, like Patty is tall. I think Patty's like 5'9" or 5'10". She's much taller than Joe, but is she tall enough to? I mean, like the top of the board. If you look at the pictures we put on our social media, the board goes pretty much to the top of the door. And Andy's a lot taller. He's like, 6 something. Could she have reached it? Maybe, possibly. I don't know. Maybe she brought a footstool with her too, because she was thinking so far ahead. Is it odd that Andy's the one who suggested this is how it probably went down? Yeah, it's weird that Andy's like, oh, I think whoever did this. Is it even odder that Andy didn't think for a second, there are hundreds of strange men working around my neighborhood, hundreds of them. And he says over and over to the police, my wife is gorgeous. My wife is beautiful. My wife gets a lot of attention, that he didn't think for a second that it could be one of these strangers, but instead it was targeted by either an ex who hadn't seen her in years, like 3 years, like Joe had not been in touch with her ex-husband, or Patty, who lived hundreds of miles away. Like, how are these your first two? How do you jump to that versus somebody around here, some unsavories. And, you know, listen, there is so much in the case file, including an entire thread on a couple of suspects who are really unsavory characters, and they hung out at McCarty's all the time. And I'm not even going to get into that in the series because we don't have enough time. It's going to have to be a 15 episode series. But the point is, there are people in the area who have like criminal records. There are sexual offenders in the area. There are people with all kinds of like violent pasts. And you think it's got to be the woman, you know, like states away. The whole thing is odd.
You mentioned what's in the police files. Then we have what's not in the police files. So Mitchell and Gail asks a question I think a lot of listeners have, and let's just answer it here. Was there any way at the time to obtain records of local calls made on a phone? Long distance would be easy to obtain because of billing records, but local call records would show when and if Joanne called her mother-in-law, right? So that's not in the file. We don't know. We don't have any records of the local calls, right?
You know, we have no records, but I was looking at the warrant or the subpoena for the, I think it was a subpoena for the records, and they specifically asked for the toll records. And the toll records would have been for long distance calls. And it makes me wonder, does that mean that local call records were not available, or they just didn't specifically ask for them? Again, this is the police gathering evidence. And we have seen in other cases where police deliberately do not gather evidence that could hurt their case. And so the question you have to look at is like, when are they gathering this? Is Patty already a suspect? Are they trying to avoid certain kinds of evidence? I just don't know at the time. Actually, that's probably something Jen could look into, because that's like the how Jen first got involved in all this work, is trying to figure out what kind of phone records exist at what time. But I just don't know if local calls were available at the time. The point being, we don't have them. We don't have them. Yeah. And I say again, man, if only Patty had made like a call, Patty had picked up the phone and called Andy that night, then this could all be put to rest. But
and let me ask this as sort of a final question before we preview next episode and wrap up. And that is, Robbie, I think you mentioned Joe took her son on a walk every day, right?
Yeah.
When the mother-in-law says she calls, they're about to go shopping, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this would be around 1:15 p.m. So does that mean that presumably, if she's alive, that they would have taken a walk that morning? Because if they're going shopping in the afternoon, there wouldn't really be time for a walk, right? So shouldn't they have already gone for a walk at that point?
I don't know what time. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it's somewhere in the file. Jen, do you remember if it was ever mentioned, like what time? I thought it was always like in the afternoon, like after lunch is when I thought. For some reason, that's what I'm remembering, but I might be misremembering that detail.
Yeah, I don't recall. I don't recall that it was like a set time. I could be totally wrong about this. I think that I remember reading that she would often take Alex for a neighborhood walk, but I don't know that it was the exact same time every day, because she was also, as Rabia mentioned in this episode, like she was pretty taking Alex to all kinds of things, like meetings with friends. I mean, the lunch that we hear about was one of like several lunches she'd had, I think, in the months since he was born, where she would drive and meet friends. So I feel like there's maybe a little bit of fluidity in her schedule, but she would often take him for a walk.
Got it.
Yeah. I think the fact that when the car is found, the stroller's in the back,
mm-hmm.
the car seat is fully in the car. It's not like only the base is there. Whether or not she had gone for a walk before or after, or beforehand, by that point, she had put the stroller in the car. And I think they only had one stroller. She had put the stroller in the trunk. She was leaving with the baby to go somewhere. Absolutely. She was leaving the house for sure. She put that car seat in, and I think she probably drove away.
All right. Well, I think that wraps up our coverage of episode 2. Rabia, what should listeners look forward to in episode 3?
In episode 3, we're going to keep following the investigation. It's still a missing persons investigation. And this is when the police are confounded. They think it's Andy, and they do everything they can, I think, in their power to try to find something on this guy. And so we're going to go over like the leads, basically, like, you know, the different leads that the police look at, how they tried to drill down on Andy, how they managed to fail at doing that. And then we're also going to look at kind of the evidence they found in the car. And we get into the police's first contact with Patricia Rohrer. So, and what she had to say about what she knew about Joe and what happened between her and Andy.
Great. All right. Well, thanks to listeners for tuning in. Thanks, Jen and Rabia. And we'll see you all back next Monday for episode 3 of The State versus Patricia Rohr.
Thank you so much, Colin. Thanks, Jen.
Thanks, Colin. Thank you.
As we all know, there is always more to the story. So tune in every Thursday during this entire season where we're going to be dropping our addendum episodes. In those episodes, we will go deeper on some of the issues raised in that week's episode, and we're going to answer listener questions. And if you want even more undisclosed content, remember, you can become a patron by signing up at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And if you've got feedback for us, you can find us at speakpipe.com/undisclosed, where you can leave us an actual voice note. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at Undisclosed Pod. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Undisclosed Pod. And we've got our own little private Facebook group called the Toward Justice Community. All you got to do is answer 3 quick questions and I will let you in. You can follow me, Rabia, on Instagram at RabiaSquared2, the number 2. And you can follow Colin at EvidenceProf on X and Blue Sky. Follow the podcast on X at Undisclosed Pod. We want to thank our sponsors, and I want to thank our intrepid team, our sound editor, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan, and my amazing investigator, Jennifer Leahy. And a very special thank you to true crime author and advocate, Tammy Mall, who made this season possible. Thank you, Tammy, for all your work.